Annalise Michelle showed all the traditional signs of being possessed by a demon. She heard the voice of the devil. She feared holy places. She growled like an angry animal. Her family thought she was possessed. The local priest agreed, and even Anna herself thought that a demon had taken control of her body. When the region's bishop finally granted permission for an exorcism, the family was relieved. Two local priests conducted their first rites on September 24th, 1975. 10 months and 67 exorcisms later, the priest finally drove the demons from Annalise, but at a horrific cost. This is the story of the 67 exorcisms of Annalise Michelle.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Weird World Podcast. My name's Carrie.
I'm Dean.
And I think this is going to be a scary episode.
Possibly. There also is going to be some trigger warnings about suicide and mental health. Just FYI.
Okie dokies.
Pretty significant ones. This is also going to be a two-parter. Trust me, it's worth it. In this first part, we're going to go all the way through those 67 exorcisms of Annalise Michelle, and including first some background about her and what happened to her and what state she was in when those exorcisms occurred. And then in part two, we'll go through, well, I don't want to give too much away, but there's going to be a trial.
Oh.
And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what may have actually happened with Annalise.
I don't know this story.
It's actually been the inspiration, so to speak, for three different movies. By the way, we'll talk a little bit more about that in the second part, in part two.
Oh, okay.
Including one where it was sort of directly, more or less, taken from as the case that was sort of directly inspired the entire movie. It's called The Exorcism of Emily Rose that came out in 2005.
Oh.
It didn't adhere, you know, all that much to Annalise, but it pretended to some degree. First, as I mentioned, let's start from some background. Let's get to know Annalise before we go over her ordeal. Anna Elizabeth Michelle, we'll call her Annalise, her family and her friends did. She was born on September 21st, 1952, in a town, I'm going to mess it up, called Liebelfing in Bavaria. Hmm. That is the southernmost state in then West Germany. The nation was still occupied by Allied troops at the time. Do you know that?
No.
It wouldn't be unoccupied in 1955. Bavaria was part of the American zone. It was divided among the four major allies. Of course, mm-hmm. The Russian zone became East Germany.
Right.
Bavaria is a pretty overwhelmingly Catholic state of Germany. It's really pretty conservative. The Germany to the north becomes a little more Protestant, but it's very heavily Catholic and so, you know, kind of old school conservative in Bavaria, which is important because the whole kind of milieu of the area and particularly her family is critical to this case. Annalise fit in pretty well with this background here. Her family was very, very religious, devoutly religious. She and her three sisters were raised by their parents, Joseph and Anna, in just a really, really deeply Catholic house. So Catholic, they attended Mass not once, no, twice a week. Every single week they went to Catholic Mass.
Yeah, I don't think that's that unusual.
Seems insane
back
to
in
me.
Those days.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. But they were. They were a really, really kind of a hardcore Catholic family household.
I'll bet you my grandmother went to Mass twice a week.
Really? Mm-hmm. Was she ever demonically possessed?
No, she was not.
Was she ever? Okay. When Annalise was still, I think, pretty young, they moved to a nearby town called Klingenberg, and that's where Annalise's father ran a sawmill. That was what he did for a living. So Joseph, her father, had even considered becoming a priest when he was younger, and they had three nuns within their immediate family. So they were very, very steeped in this religiosity. But despite this devoutness, or maybe actually feeding into it, the family had faced a scandal, a pretty horrific scandal, not long before Annalise was born. It was in 1948, and Anna, her mom, had given birth to an illegitimate child.
What?
That was huge. In that area, for that kind of a household at that time,
it was
a big, big deal. Not that long after the war, the daughter, she named Martha, would be the firstborn. I don't know. From what I've read, it's not completely clear that Joseph was the father or not. I think he was, because not long later, they got married. But this stain was so severe of her having, and the whole area in the town knew about that. She had had this illegitimate child that they made her wear a black veil during her entire wedding ceremony just to, you know, shame her. So everybody knew, hey, you can't keep being all white.
Wow.
You're not pure as a different, no, like you're supposed to be.
I mean, I'm surprised they let her get married in the Catholic Church.
True, yeah. I guess that was the compromise. I don't know. But here's the thing. Anna didn't direct, the mom didn't direct this anger or any anger toward the community. She didn't blame them. She blamed herself.
Oh, yeah.
And they blamed, you know, so did Joseph.
Yeah.
So you basically deflected all that anger that you could have been out, you know, but you embarrassed me and humiliate me. She deflected it inward, and that she accepted that she was this disgraced woman.
Yeah.
She desperately wanted penance. She wanted to make up for it. Her whole life, she wanted atonement, to be forgiven, to do good works, to wash away this horrible stain. You know, that feeds into her kids, and it would be born about 4 years after Martha.
And they kept Martha?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Yes.
My question is, It sounds like Joseph is the father.
He must have been. Again, nothing's very specific, but he must have been.
So and it's kind of clearly implicit. There was no stain on him.
No, it's always the woman's fault. You know
bullshit,
that, Carrie.
Patriarchy, Catholicism.
Well, you know what? It's, you know, yeah. People
it's
have
still
said
that way today. So
sure as hell is. So from this earliest childhood, Annalise is taught that the family, the whole family really has to atone for these past sins.
Sure.
And here's the key. Not just their sins. Their sin had been done, right? They led this now sin-free life, more or less. They felt like they had to make up for other damned people, other sinful people. They can be so good, they could sort of rescue the souls of bad people around them in the community elsewhere.
Yeah.
They really have this weird sort of dynamic going on about we have to be better so we can atone for all those other sinful people.
That's getting a little pathological. Also, weren't they up to date on their own religion? Jesus died for their sins. So as long as you repent and go to confession and say 5 Hail Marys and 2 Our Fathers, your sins are washed away.
Yeah. The Catholic Church is not known for its easy forgiveness.
The Catholic Church.
Yes, but Carrie,
it's
still,
very easy forgiveness.
No, it isn't. They still have penance to remain. You have to.
That's the 5 Hail Marys and 2 Our Fathers.
not really actually true.
Who's the fallen Catholic at this
You're
table?
The fallen Catholic.
Yeah.
But
you're the devout Catholic?
No, but you weren't really a Catholic. I mean, you were, but you were a small child. You didn't know what was happening. You just know they were dunking your head underwater and what the hell was going on. Did they? No, wait.
No, they just dribbled it on my forehead.
Okay. Yeah, you got off easy.
No, Catholics don't dunk their babies.
I don't know. Baptists do, right?
Yeah.
I've seen it in a river in
Texas. Yeah, they take you to a river or a lake.
It's a little scary.
A swimming pool, which is just looks so ridiculous.
I love the swimming pool thing. That's
no, I was 6 years genius. Old, and my godfather was holding me, and all I could, he hold you like a baby, but I'm 6. I'm not a baby. And the priest, you know, like dribbles, says some mumbo jumbo and dribbles water on your forehead. And all I could think of was, is everybody seeing my underwear right now? Is my underwear showing? I hope my underwear is not showing.
I would do it in jacuzzi, full blast, 106 degrees, every jet going. That's what I do.
Sure.
So I imagine that Annalise had a very strict curfew. So she grew up really conservative household, really just, again, taught this idea that we have to be better for others. You have the twice weekly mass. But there's a lot more. Annalise and her older sister, Martha, spent almost every day at home praying instead of playing with the neighborhood kids. So they could come home from school. This is before Annalise was even, you know, could go to school. And they would just pray all day long.
Yeah.
Kids are out fun, playing ollie-ollocks and free. No, wait, hide and go seek. And they're inside playing tag, playing, what's that one where you have to break, Red Rover. All those old school games.
Typical games they played in Bavaria?
Germany, 1950s Bavaria? No, I did not. I assume that they played similar games. They for sure did not. When Martha was only 8 years old, though, she died.
Oh, no.
That left Annalise 4 years old as almost like she was the oldest now. She would eventually have, they'd have three more sons, so she'd have three younger brothers. But this kind of left her as kind of the family burden was a lot of it was on her shoulders.
Yeah.
Klingenberg.
Wait, how did Martha die?
Some sickness, some illness.
Okay.
What, do you think they murdered her? Are you going to turn this podcast to a murder podcast from a possession podcast?
I'm just saying she was the embodiment of their sin, basically.
She was. That's
so
true.
I was worried about her.
I'm assuming it was illness.
Okay.
Klingenberg, the town they lived in, had a train station where the town's like drug addicts sort of hung out. I think they slept there. They slept on the hard floor of this train station, better than being out in the elements, right? I guess it was sort of tolerated, apparently.
Were there a lot of drug addicts at the time?
There's always been drug addicts here. You think there weren't drug addicts in post-war Germany? Plenty.
I don't know.
There's probably still morphine running around from, some old vials.
Battlefields.
Of morphine here. From battlefields. I don't know. But yeah, no, there are drug addicts everywhere. Always has been, always will be. And Annalise, though, was made to sleep on the hard stone floor in some part of their house to atone for the sins of these drug addicts sleeping on the floor of the train station. Well, that's just a...
Did the parents have to sleep on the hard floor too?
No, Annalise did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So this is abusive. I mean, this is,
you know, but Annalise, she grew up in this. This was second nature to her. This was
of course,
the norm to her.
That's what happens with abused people.
That's true. Despite this, though, she got along well. She had friends. She was pretty outgoing. She was happy. She, you know, she would go to school. She prayed afterwards, but she had friends at school. And
she probably loved school.
Oh, I know.
Are you kidding?
She was smart, too. She was good at learning new languages, for instance. She seemed normal. She seemed happy. Increasingly, though, as she grew older, her home life began to just get stressed her out. It was very fretful. So she started suffering from a string of illnesses. She got measles, mumps, scarlet fever, all when she was fairly young. I guess they didn't have vaccinations. Don't know when they had vaccinations for those. They now come in one shot, I think. Aren't those all three in one shot?
What did you say? Measles, mumps?
Measles, mumps, and scarlet fever. Maybe not.
Measles, mumps, and rubella. is the okay. Shot. But yeah, no, they probably didn't have shots back then.
I don't
then.
Think they did. But she got those. She survived them. But she, you know.
Well, she was born in 52?
52, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is, yeah.
I mean, the they 50s. Were probably developed at some point during her lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, we got them and we were born in the 60s, so.
But by the time she was a teenager, she was kind of sickly and a little bit neurotic. Okay? It's going to get worse. So Annalise's world was turned really upside down and really changed forever when she was 16 years old. She was at school. She was sitting in her classroom. Suddenly, she blacked out and she collapsed to the floor. She was kind of unconscious for a little while, and then suddenly she started having convulsions, very significant, severe seizures right there in front of the whole classroom. The teacher comes over. You can imagine what's going on. They try to stuff a pencil down her throat or something like that. Not down her throat, in her mouth, right?
Yeah.
And she finally did. The seizure stopped, and she kind of came out of it. But for a while afterward, her friends and the school classmates would say she seemed like she was almost in this like trance-like state. And she remained in that for a little while.
Which is a seizure.
It's still the remains. She was kind of in a daze.
Yeah,
trance-like and then kind of in a daze even after the seizure.
Yeah, I think they're called like silent seizures or something like that, where you can be never have like a convulsive type seizure. You could just be sitting there and it just looks like you're spacing out.
Okay.
And you are having a seizure.
And you can have both?
I'm sure.
She apparently did. She had a severe seizures and then this trance-like dazed state for some time. Questioned later that day, she said she had no memory of the seizures or the being in some kind of a trance-like state either. So she goes home, and later that night, she's in bed, she's asleep, it's late, early in the morning, when she wakes up from this dead sleep with just like gasping, and she was frantic, and she's able to, I guess, hoarsely whisper for her mom, and her mom came into her room, and she said that she felt like something was pressing down on her chest, and that she was almost like partially paralyzed. She could barely move. She's also said she can barely breathe, and that she could only speak in a whisper, and she wet the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So all these, you know, her mom comforts her best she can, but this was the same, I guess, later that night of that first seizure in 1968. So she would have been 16 years old. I mentioned that, I think.
Yeah.
The next year, August 24th, is now 1969. She's not quite 17. Annalise was stricken by a second seizure. She again went into this trance-like state following this seizure. This time, by the way, it was at home. It was at nighttime while she was in bed. She also, again, wet the bed. So now, you know, something serious here. They took her to the hospital, and she saw a neurologist and examined her and did, like, EEG. And he said, you know, it's more or less normal brain activity I'm seeing in the EEG, but my diagnosis is that she has temporal lobe epilepsy.
Right.
We'll talk quite a bit more about that in part two. But of course, you know, as you know, this affliction can cause these grand mal seizures, but it also does cause memory loss, and it causes, critically, both visual and audio hallucinations.
Really?
Yeah. So bear that in mind as the story continues. Her family, though, apparently thought differently. Even here at the second seizure, already they're talking, probably amongst themselves only, I imagine, that this latest episode, the second seizure, may be some kind of a sign of demonic possession.
Jeez.
So, I mean, this is a hyper-religious family. It's a family that also felt themselves just sort of sin-stained and unworthy. A family that felt a need, you know, even really wanted to atone. And so they would be tested. They would be punished. So it made perfect sense to them that their daughter would be this target of this retribution. Yeah. So think about it. Combine the sense of this sin, this deserving retribution, put it in that ultra-Catholic setting, mm-hmm. and it would be almost surprising if they didn't come to the determination that this might be some form of demonic possession. She was, their daughter was the center of this kind of peculiarly, I can't pronounce that word. Peculiarly, pronounce that word for me.
Peculiarly?
That's it.
It's a terrible word.
It's a horrible word. I tried twice and I gave up and gave it to you. But this kind of retribution.
Yeah.
This is a very Catholic answer to this whole kind of the context of what's happening. We're a sinful family. We're super religious. We're super Catholic. Bad things are happening to your daughter. Things we don't fully understand. This might be the devil.
Yeah, but the doctors do understand it, and they've told us what it is.
Of course they have. But, you know, you're like, okay, you go ahead and take your science. I'm going to take, I mean, their answer was not found in science. It was found in religion.
Are the little brothers around,
you know, they're,
by this time?
You hear very little about them.
Okay, but they do exist.
They do exist, yeah. In one source, at least, says she had three brothers. You hear very little about them otherwise.
Okay.
In February of the next year, it's now 1970, Annalise was hospitalized, but it was for tuberculosis.
Oh, God. Tuberculosis. Poor Annalise.
I know. She's I guess she's sick all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not, I guess, obviously, it wasn't the really bad kind. You can be cured of tuberculosis, right? By 1970, they had antibiotics, I think, that could cure tuberculosis, I believe. I'm going to say yes. But anyway, she was hospitalized with tuberculosis. While there, she told the doctors that she had been hallucinating both colors and sounds. But when she prayed on her rosary, she felt this kind of euphoric feeling. Keep that in mind. We'll come back to that in just a second. Her doctors, again, tested her. They reconfirmed the diagnosis of epilepsy. And so I think at this point they put her on medication.
But she wasn't having more seizures. Or had
she had the second seizure, so she had two so far now.
Right, but now it's over a year later.
The second one was about 6 months, August to February. So at this point when she had tuberculosis, the second seizure had been about 6 months ago.
Okay.
I don't think they did put her on medication
so
yet.
She wasn't having lots of them.
No.
They were not very frequent.
She had two in about a 1 year period, and now it's been about 18 months or so, and she's had two. Weirdly, though, fairly soon after, when she started praying and she'd have the rosary beads in her hand, she would now start feeling evil. She would have these hallucinations that she described as making her feel evil whenever she would pray with her rosary beads, which, again, she's hyper-Catholic. These should be a good thing. These should be, you know, give you comfort. So she became very depressed. She had suicidal thoughts, hence the trigger warning earlier. She heard voices in her head now. These are classic schizophrenic or, you know, significant mental illness now. This is beyond epilepsy, I would argue.
Why? They said it could cause...
Voices that are distinct like that, I don't know that the temporal lobe epilepsy causes that kind of distinctness.
Okay.
And we'll see. Again, she's going to get much worse.
Okay.
She heard voices that were pretty clear. They said, you're damned, you're evil, you're unworthy. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, and again, so keep remember earlier, they're saying more or less what she would expect them to say, what her family has sort of taught them that she should expect them to say. So eventually Annalise was committed to a psychiatric hospital for more intensive treatment. Again, I think by this time her doctors realized this is beyond epilepsy as well. While in the hospital, it's June 1970 now, she suffered a third seizure. And oddly, because apparently for the first time, she was then put on anticonvulsive drugs, which seems like you would have done that earlier. But you're right. She had one.
Yeah.
They didn't. She had one almost a year later. They still didn't. Now it's the third one. It had been less than 2 years. And so they put her on anticonvulsive drugs. One of those was Dilantin, which I think is still a leading medication for epilepsy.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it, but I don't know.
The medications, though, really didn't help that much. Her hallucinations continued, and they kind of morphed into much more specific and much more overtly religious motifs. So she said that she saw, quote, devil faces off and on throughout the day. She would just, I don't know, close her eyes, and she saw these demonic faces in her head, and she'd hallucinate them pretty frequently. Very often, also, her own face would squeeze in and just sort of ball up into this involuntary grimace. In fact, the Germans have a word for it. It's called Fratzen, which means literally, quote, grimacing faces.
Hmm.
And, I mean, at this point, it's clear she's getting worse. She was put now on antipsychotic drugs in, this is, I guess, the summer now of 1970. And some of those drugs included Aolept, which is something like clopromazine, which is still sold under the brand name Thorazine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's used to battle schizophrenia
mm-hmm.
and also delusion. It really is used for fairly significant and serious psychological disorders. So she's now on some pretty heavy-duty drugs by now. She should be just 18 years old, not even quite 18 years old. And remember, this is a very serious situation. She had enough treatment where eventually she could go home. And then actually the next year, she began going to college.
I'm surprised her parents allowed her to take medication for it.
They're not Christian Science.
It sounds like they're accepting the medical / psychiatric cause of what's going on with her.
Yes.
And so that's good.
It's early still.
Yeah.
That's going to start to wane. But at this point still, they want to help their daughter. Her mom especially probably felt like, I think I know what's going on here, but let's try everything. Let's see if the medication works and if it helps her. And it seems to have for at least early on here, at least enough so she can start going to college and take classes.
Unfortunately, these are not simple psychiatric issues that are one and done. You know, like the first medication works like a charm and you're perfect. It's often not an easy road.
There is no wonder drug psychiatric medication yet. We're probably nowhere near it.
Yeah.
They can, in her case, it seems like they at best dulled some of her symptoms, at least temporarily, but they were never super effective. She became more and more depressed. Her health began to flag even more. She deteriorated as her mental impairment just kind of resisted the psychiatric treatment and the medication she was undergoing. And again, it got her good enough to go to college, but it wasn't working. She was still having these hallucinations. She's still really depressed. So even at this early stage, it's not working. After 5 years of medication and treatment, she became herself just super frustrated, super angry. She herself thought, this isn't working. I've got to try something else. She had changed too. Her friends and her family, and especially her friend set from, I think high school and then early on in college, said that she became a different person. She became more withdrawn, but she even became unfriendly. Whereas before, despite those occasional seizures, again, she had been outwardly happy again. She had the most of her childhood. Yeah. She wasn't sickly and she wasn't super depressed. To others, she kept friends. She seemed like a fairly normal person, fairly outgoing, again, doing well in school when she was able to study. But then now she's being more withdrawn, and she even started to just like have these outbursts of anger and just lash out at people and everyone around her. So they're noticing significant changes in her personality as the medication is not working.
Yeah.
And the worst was probably the depression. It just consumed her. Here's a quote from her. She says, "This is no longer a depression. This is a condition." She told this to one of her doctors.
Yeah.
She said, "She felt like someone else is manipulating me." I think that's a little bit of a depression statement. She felt out of control. Quote, "My will is not my own," end quote. She became withdrawn more, even to the point where she started to just to not feel any affection for her boyfriend. She had a boyfriend, and they were happy. But then gradually she started feeling, she described herself as just feeling ice cold. And she just couldn't work up any affection towards anyone, friends, family, boyfriend. She said, quote, "I can't feel any love at all. I am all numb, sort of. I can't feel emotions like that."
I mean, that sounds like depression.
It's severe depression, but it's also specific about, you know, not, I don't love anyone. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how, I don't understand. I don't know how to feel that. I don't know how to, you know, even though I used to about these same people.
Right, yeah.
Weirdly, at some point, she began to shy away from religious items and iconography. Like they have crucifixes and crosses and things like that in her home. And she would like not want to go near the crucifixes. Again, this is not like her. It's not like her upbringing, right? She almost acted like she feared those things. She further disengaged then from her friend set. She had a secular friend set in her early college days. As this is happening, she starts getting rid of those friends. She starts ignoring those friends. And she started hanging out with this super religious Catholic little group at her college. And those become kind of all of her friends. They were considered like, they were looked at, I get the sense, as these kind of weird religious zealots. And she became very friendly with them and dropped her friendships with her previous friends. All she wanted to talk about apparently was just God and religion. It just consumed her by this point. She started becoming like a doomsayer. She would talk about not just her damnation, like I'm damned, but she thought everyone's damned. The end of the world is coming. We're getting closer and closer to annihilation. She said that she spoke to the Virgin Mary. And she became obsessed with, I've never heard of this person, 19th century German mystic and supposed prophet. Her name was Barbara Wiegand. She became obsessed with her history and her teachings. And Barbara Wiegand had also said she had been in communication with the Virgin Mary.
Oh, great.
So she's leading more and more this kind of really secluded, hyper-religious existence. It's almost like she was ripe for the taking.
Yeah.
So eventually, almost it seems like inevitably, Annalise herself began to believe that, you know what, maybe I am possessed by a demon or demons.
Yeah.
You know, I've been on this medication for 5 years now. I'm not getting better. The treatment, the psychiatric treatment is not getting better. She apparently had just those three seizures, but now, again, it's not really just an epilepsy thing. It's a psychosis kind of a thing. And those medications and those treatment for that are just aren't helping her.
Right.
So she became certain that she could not be helped by these traditional means. This was a religious problem that would require a religious solution. So the family, naturally, very much agreed. Our daughter is probably possessed by a demon.
So that came from her?
That came from her and the family.
Originally?
Remember, her mom started talking about it after the second seizure, apparently.
Yeah.
But, you know, and as Annalise herself became more frustrated with the lack of results from the medication, she became to believe that herself, too. Remember, she's seeing devil faces now. It was a process. It was an evolution. I don't know, you know.
But were her parents talking like that all along?
I don't know.
Or that's what I'm just curious. And
probably. For sure there's some element of that, at least for about 5 years. Remember, that second seizure was 1970. So during that, if her mom thought that then, she wasn't not thinking that for the next 5 years, I'm sure. So it's about 1974 or so now, and the family says, okay, we're going to do something about this. So they start approaching local priests, and telling them about their daughter's case and asking for help. And she's really pretty fastly deteriorating now. Fastly? That's not a real word. her health is you know, compromised. Again, she's been sick a lot. She's still relatively healthy and relatively normal body weight. But she sees the devil all the time now, more and more. She's hearing the voices still, despite her treatment. And she'll be like in a silent prayer. And they just start yelling at her that you're going to rot in hell. You're damned. And she's hearing that more and more. It seems, again, her affliction now seems much, much more so. This kind of demonic possession is taking on this religious context very overtly now.
Yeah.
But she did lose her appetite. She's becoming physically weaker. She said that the demons were preventing her from eating.
Oh,
so she wants to eat. They won't let her.
Yeah.
Right? Demons are not usually very nice to their host.
No, they're
well
not.
Known. They don't really care.
But they should want to keep her body healthy.
You would think. Yeah, but you know.
You just move on to the next one,
I suppose. That's true. Again, in Supernatural, a black cloud of smoke comes out from the mouth and they can invade someone else right away. So when they kill off that body, they're not that concerned. That's true. So rather than eating meals, apparently the demons let her eat spiders and flies because she started eating spiders and flies that she captured in her room.
Like Lily is right now. I think she's eating a spider or something.
Probably, yes. She also would sometimes steal coal from the fireplace and eat the coal.
Oof.
She wants, now again, this is, I probably should have said something a few seconds ago, but if you don't want to listen to this, don't listen for the next 10 seconds, because she also, at least one time, maybe more than once, she urinated on the floor and she would get down on her hands and knees and she would lap it up like a dog, her own urine.
Yeah.
She also sometimes barked like a dog, and sometimes she'd even just rip her clothes off in the middle of the room, you know, screaming for the demon to get out of her.
Yeah.
So she's severely psychotic by this point.
Mm-hmm.
She hardly sleeps anymore. She sleeps like an hour or two a night. Instead of sleeping, most nights she'd walk around their house begging Jesus to help her, just, you know, begging overtly, sometimes screaming for Jesus or God to help her and release her from
And they're
this
not
punishment.
Taking her back to the hospital?
I, at this point, they must be pretty, again, they've already approached priests to get help from them, meaning an exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
They're convinced now the hospitals can't do her no more good.
Well,
we need to make the church help us.
I'm assuming she has also stopped taking any medication.
We'll talk about the later during the trial phase, but it's unclear. She may have always been not great at consistently taking medication.
Yeah. Clearly, she's not taking her medication.
We don't know for sure, but it's very likely that, and at this point, she's almost certainly off her meds entirely.
Yes.
I'm sure she is. Her behavior, though, was very inconsistent. One minute she'd be like knock a religious picture of Jesus, you know, every Catholic household has one. She'd knock it off the wall in anger and fear, and or take her rosary beads and slam them, you know, against the wall and try to destroy them. And the next minute, she'd fall to her knees, literally, and genuflect and ask God for forgiveness. It got to the point where she would genuflect. She went down hard on presumably hardwood floors.
Yeah.
400 to 600 times every single day.
Oops.
She would wreck her knees. Her knees first became swollen, then became badly injured. She had damaged her ligaments and her tendons. She's constantly, I imagine, even kind of compulsively moving them down on her knees 400 to 600 times every single day.
Yeah.
It was horrifically self-destructive behavior. So now they've gone to the local priest, and the family's begging them, telling them, here's what's happening to our daughter, here's what's going on. Will you please, please, please conduct an exorcism of our daughter? Because they had become convinced that that was going on. That was the only answer. At first, the priest politely said, no, let's just hold on here. We urge you to keep Annalise on her medication and continue to see her doctors. And they said, anyway, the local bishop has to give us permission for an exorcism, and we don't have it. It's a pretty big step. It's not easy to get. The church, by this point, had kind of frowned upon exorcism, certainly without really solid proof that they really were possessed by a demon.
Yeah.
We'll go over some of those later, by the way. Again, when we talk about what happened to her, what really was going on, we'll talk about what those exact proofs are that the Catholic Church wants to see to say, yes, you are demonically possessed. But at this point, they're unconvinced. At the very least, they're uncertain, so they don't approach the bishop yet for permission. Then Annalise, this must be at least 1974, maybe even early 1975, I'm not sure. It's probably 1975 by now. She went on an excursion to Italy with a family friend named Frau Hein, I don't know her first name, whose business was organizing pilgrimages for Catholics to like venerated sites, like holy places, right? Okay. She would be going to Italy all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case, she said, hey, I'm going to San Damiano in Italy, and I'll take Annalise with me. I'm going to a very holy site. Maybe it could help. And so she does. She escorts Annalise down there to this shrine in San Damiano, and there's a church there as well, and there's like a holy spring. And once inside that church, that chapel that's on the grounds, I think it was outside. She was outside, and there's a big crucifix, let's say on the wall of the church. I'm not completely positive, but, and she was just repelled by it. She told Frau Hein, oh, no, I can't go near it. I hate it. I'm terrified. I can't get close to it. And then Frau Hein took her to the holy spring to drink of the holy water. You can drink, and it was said to have healing properties.
Uh-huh.
She couldn't get close to it. She tried super, super hard, but she couldn't get there. She couldn't go near it, and she would not drink the water. The woman, Frau Hein, was immediately convinced. She thought, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
She is possessed. She's possessed by a demon. This seems like a demon inside your body would make you do or not allow you to do.
Right.
So she went home, she brought her with her, she told the family, here's what happened. And she said, I'm convinced this is demonic possession. So they went back to a priest, and they finally found a priest. After this latest story, they found a priest named Ernst Alt, who said, okay, this sounds right. Let me talk to Annalise. So he examined Annalise. He listened to her stories, and they listened to the family too. Here's all the things that's been going on. You know, the devil faces, she's tossing, breaking her rosary beads, and all that kind of thing. She's doing these very irreligious kinds of things when she comes from this very religious household, and she herself is a hugely religious person and a very strident Catholic. He was aware of the medical diagnosis that. About epilepsy and about these psychotic drugs, and she knew about the medication she had been on. But he would say later, she didn't look like an epileptic to me.
Oh, okay, because priests know how to identify epileptics.
He apparently thought so.
Okay.
He said, I never saw her have a seizure.
She had
three seizures in a two-year period.
Case closed.
She was also, remember, on Dilantin, she was on anti-convulsion medications.
Uh-huh.
Medication. I think the San Damiano event appears to have played a really critical role in Alt's decision, though, because he found it very, very convincing. He wrote about it when he eventually would write to the bishop. He wrote about it at length, and he said he had spoken to Frau Hein. He found out exactly what happened. Frau Hein was the woman who took her?
Yes.
And he's really impressed with what happened. He said about how Annalise like desperately wanted to reach that church's crucifix and tried so hard, but she said like the ground would burn her feet like fire the closer she got to that crucifix. He said that she even retreated and then tried to sneak around behind the crucifix and come at it from behind and see if that would work, and it didn't. She still was repelled by it and couldn't get close enough to it. When she had walked by a picture of Jesus inside the chapel at San Damiano, she had violently cast her eyes away. She couldn't even look at it. And more recently, couldn't even look at like medals and pictures of saints in her family's home. They had lots of those things. A lot of Catholic families have those things. She couldn't look at them. She couldn't bring herself to even open her eyes and look at them.
Yeah.
So to him, that's showing signs that there's a demon inside of her.
Mm-hmm.
Annalise wrote to Father Alt herself. Remember, she desperately wants to be exorcised.
Yeah.
She's all in on this. She's convinced herself. It's not just her family. She also is very much convinced that she is demonically possessed.
Yeah.
She wrote to Alt, quote, I am nothing. Everything about me is vanity. What should I do? I have to improve. You pray for me. And she later told him to his face, said, I want to suffer for other people, but this is so cruel. So it's like, yeah, I do want to suffer. This suffering is helping other people, but
this
please get
this
demon out of me. It's too much. I can't handle it. So Alt was sold. He was on board. He now believed he was in the presence of demons inside of this young woman.
Yeah.
He went to Bishop Joseph Stangl with the case and the, you know, the evidence such as it is for a demonic possession. And after, quote, careful consideration and good information, end quote, the bishop granted permission to conduct an exorcism. The bishop insisted, though, that a priest named Arnold Renz would actually conduct the exorcism. He was like apparently more, you know, he knew more about the rites. There's very specific rites you're supposed to do and prayers you're supposed to say during an exorcism for Catholics. And this other Arnold Renz was more familiar with those. So he said, Arnold Renz will be in charge. You, Father Alt, you will assist. You will be there as well. That's fine with me. This permission, though, was granted on one other critical condition, and that is that it would have to be conducted in complete secrecy. The exorcism would be done in the Michelle's home. Only those two priests and the immediate family would be allowed to be present and talk about it. There were some other local priests who were aware of it, but it was a closely held secret of what was occurring. This is now September of 1975. She is, 23 years old. It would later be revealed that Bishop Stengel had simply took everything that Father Alt had told him at face value.
Yeah.
He didn't look into it in any way, shape, or form. He didn't ask for any proofs of what was happening from that Annalise was experiencing. He did not ask for any other opinions from her doctors or other medical professionals who had seen her and treated her, had much more experience with her. In fact, that cone of silence that he dictated, that prevented any of those medical professionals from finding out about it, which I think was clearly the intent. Yeah.
But that edict came from the bishop, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, still, I mean, there was clear intent there. He wanted to keep this on the down low.
Yeah.
So now the exorcism. Catholic exorcisms go back centuries, as you might guess.
Yeah.
The rites to conduct them to, you know, cast demons from the bodies of the possessed were actually codified in 1614 in a treatise that's called the Rituae Romanum. And this was written down like that because throughout the 1500s, exorcisms had become hugely popular. They had surged in popularity throughout for a century or so. So finally in the early 1600s, they said, okay, let's write this down. How you do it? Let's codify this. Let's do this right. And you notice that's during the height of the witch scare in the 1500s when people were getting possessed all the time and they had to have priests exorcise these demons.
Well, did it work?
Well, the phrase you're supposed to say that was supposed to work the best during an exorcism was, quote, Vade retro Satana, which means go back, Satan. Demons seem like snowflakes.
Yeah.
Don't they? I mean, just, okay, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Obviously, they don't work that well. We've all seen exorcisms. They last a lot longer. You don't just say three words and it's done, but that was one of the things you were supposed to say. There are other things. There are certain passages of the Bible and certain prayers that you're supposed to say. It was kind of quasi-ritualized.
The power of Christ compels you.
That's for sure one of them.
Assuming it's one of them.
While tossing holy water on them and dodging the vomit. In more modern times, though, the practice of exorcism in the Catholic world had become kind of frowned upon and had waned dramatically, even in the 1800s. I think by the 1800s, it was not common. By the 1960s, just before this happened, it was extremely rare.
Mm-hmm.
It was not common at all. Then the film The Exorcist was released in 1973, and that would generate a tremendous amount of buzz and interest in exorcisms, but that was mostly in the United States. Where that happened.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite the same. In 1975, Germany, when and where this took place, exorcisms were still very much a rarity, which I think is illustrated by the secrecy surrounding Annalise's treatment at the hands of Father Alt and Father Renz and this silence dictated by the bishop.
Yeah.
He was embarrassed, I don't know, worried. At the very least, he thought that this could be, had to have thought this could be some bad media.
Yeah.
So on September 24th, 1975, the two priests arrived at the Michelle home with Bibles and rosaries. And if they had seen the exorcist, I imagine a few empty buckets and tons of cans of air freshener, maybe even a change of clothes or two. By the way, you're supposed to wear certain garments too. It's very specific garments that you wear when you conduct these exorcisms.
Really?
Yeah.
They, not just their dress robes.
It's nice like that, but I imagine there's a lot of white, so you can see the pea colored vomit, the green, you know, pea green vomit all over your scarf or whatever.
Scarf.
Well, what's the tunic? I don't know what the hell, but you know, I'm just going by the movie The Exorcist, and they wear white, if I remember, which at some point, which seems crazy given what's going to happen in that room. I'd wear a nice a black that kind of hides those stains. That's what I would do,
okay.
Fashion-wise. They couldn't have known at the time, but both Alton and Renz were in for an unimaginable ordeal. They would visit the Michelle home an astounding 67 times over the next 10 months. That's more than twice a week on average.
Yeah.
Their sessions would sometimes last an hour or two, but they lasted sometimes as long as 4 hours.
Yeah.
So this was grueling.
Yeah, you know why it wasn't working?
Why?
Because she wasn't possessed by demons.
Stop it. You don't know that.
Oh, I do know
I'm
that.
I'm keeping an open mind. As they, I guess, read passages from the Bible and said, go back, Satan, mm-hmm. and things like that, and as they prayed over this clearly mentally disturbed young woman, Annalise more and more took on the trappings of that traditionally possessed thing. She started to growl and snarl and scream. She spoke in this voice that was, we're going to listen to her in just a minute. It's not her normal speaking voice by any stretch of course, imagination, but it sounds ominous and foreboding. It sounds animal-like almost. Over time, she would say that there were not one, not two, but six demons in possession of her body and often her mind.
Yeah.
These demons included Lucifer himself. So I don't know that you really need other demons when you've got Lucifer in you, but she did have five more.
Mm-hmm.
They also included a villain from the Old Testament. That'd be Abel's brother Cain, the bad one. They had a villain from the New Testament. That was early Christian traitor Judas Iscariot, who 30 pieces of silver turned in Jesus. They had a villain from the long ago past. That was your favorite fiddle-playing Roman emperor, Nero.
So these are just...
These are demons. These
old-timy are, villains who died and of course, now, became
and
demons.
Now they became demons, and okay. now they're possessing poor Annalise.
And this came from Annalise.
Yes, it did. And, well, it came from the demons inside of Annalise telling the priest this during the exorcism.
Oh, gotcha.
They also included a villain from the recent past. That'd be Nazi warmonger Adolf Hitler.
Ooh.
And finally, a villain, a very specific villain from... the recent past, that was a recently disgraced priest named Fleischmann. I don't know who that is, but they had this bad priest named Fleischmann as well. These demons were apparently, by the way, not on the same page all the time, other than wanting to maintain control of Annalise. So sometimes they'd bicker among themselves. For instance, there's a passage where Hitler spouts off that quote, "People are stupid as pigs. They think it's all over after death. It goes on." End quote. That was Hitler. It was like, how dumb are you people? Obviously. Judas was super unimpressed. He retorted that Hitler just had a, quote, big mouth, end quote. And he didn't have much to back that up because he has, quote, no real say in hell. So they're fighting about who's the badass, the more
Hitler
badass
has no
demon,
power. No.
Hitler or Judas. Judas is like, hey, I betrayed Jesus. What did you do, Hitler, besides kill 6 million
He's
Jews?
He's been there the longest. So.
I guess.
Yeah.
So these demons aren't nice to her or each other.
I mean, this sounds like a Mel Brooks version of an exorcism.
This is absolutely true.
Not real life.
So Annalise's voice, as I mentioned a minute ago, was often low and kind of terrifying when the demons were in control, mm-hmm. which apparently was every time the priest came over to exorcise her. I don't know how much she's doing that.
When they're not there?
When they're not there.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. They recorded their sessions, though, at least many of their sessions, and these recordings exist now, and they're on YouTube, and I'm going to play you a couple here in just a second. You might be frightened by this. If you're frightened by demonic possession, don't listen to it. There is a couple of audio clips. Here, I'm going to play the first one here now. Okay, here it is. Okay, what she said during that was, Father Rand says, I'm going to translate what that was. That was in German, also demon.
Yeah.
And it starts with Father Renz saying, why are you at all here? She, Annalise growls, I have the right to be in this woman. I will carry this brat so long until she croaks. This dumbass bitch. And she screamed there. You heard that. For us, there is no coming back. Never. for all eternity. I don't know which demon that was.
Okay.
I'm going to play you another one now that specifically, I'm not going to play the entire stretch of it, but you will, in this next audio portion of one of the exorcisms, she first says, like, this is Hitler speaking, and Hitler, you know, rants for a little bit. Then it's Cain, then it's Nero, and this audio clip has all six of her demons at some point. I imagine this is a mashup. So she spoke in the voice of all of these demons at different times, these sort of world of famous demons.
Ja, ich wünsche auch für die anderen Leute, damit die nicht mehr kommen so. Aber dass die dann so schlimm ist und so grausam.
What that is that's the actual voice of Annalise. So for comparison purposes, this is actually Annalise's voice recorded during the same period. That's her normal speaking voice that you're hearing right now. Now she's going to speak in the voice of one of her demons. I believe it's first Cain. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Hitler. This is Cain. I'll just play one more and then we'll. You can tell, and then Nero speaks and so on. You can tell that very frequently she was just doing these kind of long,
sounds,
guttural growls and sounds. There's plenty of time. Don't get me wrong. I mean, she's having theological discussions with these priests at the time and arguing with them. And again, she's very kind of this doomsayer. All of her demons are anyway. And she they even have very specific kind of modern debates about the current state of Catholicism at different times. Those voices you hear in between, of course, is either Father Renz or Father Alt, and they stay very calm, and they're fairly soft-spoken throughout. None of the things I've listened to, they never get worked up. They're very calm. They're very matter-of-fact. You can tell you heard her normal speaking voice. She sounds, I don't have a translation, by the way, for that last one, but most of it was just growling anyway. Yeah. When the demons were at bay and Annalise was in control herself, she would often just like bemoan her fate. You know, why me? She felt she was doomed, but at least she's like, I'm eventually, this is going to kill me. These demons are going to kill me, but at least I'm dying in a good cause.
And you can tell from the cause. What's the cause?
The cause, remember, her sins, given her past, are able to atone for the sins of others. She felt that very much was, you know, she was suffering for the sins of others.
Wow. So even this was thrust upon her for others?
Yes, it was. You can tell from the recording that the demons thought so too. They were saying, well, I guess you heard the early one, we're going to keep this brat. She's doomed. She's not going to make it. We're not going to leave. So they, you know, the demons speaking through Annalise said the same thing, you know. But there were interludes where the demons would kind of complain about how little people prayed out there and how so many people had fallen away from the strict ways of the church, which seems very unusual for a demon to not want that. Like, these people just aren't praying enough.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. These people, these bad non-Catholic people. So in part two, we'll talk more about what that probably means. So this goes on for day after day, week after week, month after month, but it wasn't all this pure kind of just talking. You heard how calm they were. Well, in real life, Annalise would often kind of writhe around and sometimes even lash out. So very frequently, and more so, the priest would actually have her tied very tightly to her bed and constrained for the entire exorcism on a given day. They would say they didn't want to prevent injury to herself or to them.
Right.
But it was, you know, it's not a good look. Again, you probably had this need for secrecy. Again, they're audio taping all of this. There's no, of course, no videotape at this time. But just as with her medical treatment, her religious treatment just didn't seem to help. She's not getting any better. Again, this goes on for 10 months. Gradually, she started eating less. Then she more or less stopped eating altogether. Her eyes, you didn't see the pictures. We'll show pictures. If you don't see them, don't see them. She's in horrific condition. Her eyes are black. I mean, black. She had black eyes. She has bruises at times.
You mean not her eyeballs? Like
her
like
eye, her round eye. Like you had it, like you get punched in the eye twice. And she had bruises all over her withering body. She's getting skinnier and skinnier. She fractured some teeth in all the writhing and physical things she was doing. Her knees, of course, were already a mess from all that genuflecting. So yeah. She could barely walk. She could toward the end of these exorcisms, she only could walk with help.
Wow.
She was just, it was a physical and mental ordeal that she was going through.
Yeah.
And still, the priest prayed away as Annalise's six demons, you know, gnashed and growled and screamed and ranted on every single day. Again, even conducting these theological arguments with them, and Annalise just withered and withered throughout this entire process. She was emaciated, bedridden, and broken young woman by July 30th, 1976, when the priest conducted their 67th and final exorcism. At this point, she weighed at most about 70 pounds.
Wow.
Other sources say she weighed roughly 30 kilos, which is about 66 pounds. I don't know what her normal weight had been. She wasn't a big girl. She's a normal size woman. She was just a stick figure.
I was going to say that's beyond.
She basically stopped eating.
Yeah, she's
eating and drinking, by the way. She could no longer walk at this point, and she possibly had contracted pneumonia. I don't know this for a fact. I don't think we know for sure if she had pneumonia because they did not take her to any medical doctors.
Well, I was going to say she got down to that weight and her parents didn't.
Her parents, those priests, did not lift one finger to take her to a doctor or to a hospital. Never. Yeah. The next day, July 1st, Annalise died.
Yeah.
Her mother went to her room about 8 o'clock in the morning and found her dead. Her last words, I think the previous night had been, quote, please, absolution. And her last words were, Mama, stay with me. I'm afraid. Officially, Annalise died of, quote, advanced emaciation, end quote.
Yeah,
owing
she's
to,
starved to death.
Owing to severe malnutrition and dehydration.
Yeah.
She wasn't drinking or eating at the end there. The priest, for their part, declared victory. At least the demons had been cast out of Annalise's wrecked body. They thought by the end they had cast them out, and they let that vessel go. That was their, you know, we won. Mm-hmm. That is the end of part one. On an up note, obviously, I apologize for that. It's a natural ending because next in part two, we're going to go over the court case. Yes, you heard that right. There was a court case. This was a huge cause célèbre in Germany in the late 1970s, the two priests and the two priests were put on trial, and so were her parents were put on trial for their treatment of Annalise Michel. Then we'll discuss about, okay, what just happened? What was it exactly? Was it demonic possession or was it some kind of a disease? What did happen? We'll talk about what are those things that you're looking for to find out if someone really is demonically possessed, or could it have been something else? And there's more than one possibility there. And we'll just talk a little bit about kind of the lessons learned from this. And finally, we'll end with kind of how it stands today. There actually still is. I'll say this. There are still people in Germany who venerate her grave to this day in Bavaria.
Because why? Because
we'll talk about that in part two. So hope you listen to part two. That's next. We'll be a little more technical. Again, this trial is a pretty interesting trial, though. And then we'll talk about, we'll try to take a little bit of a dive into what happened, what the doctors thought, and what the priest thought. That's part two. Please join us.
Can't wait.
Don't be too depressed by part one.
I'm very sad about how she died.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible. Regardless of what you think that she was going through, or what you think that the true outcome was, this poor girl suffered horrifically.
Yeah.
And people that could have helped her did not help her.
Yeah.
No,
do have sympathy for her parents.
Oh, for sure.
But yeah, you don't neglect.
Although you might have less sympathy after part two. So we'll talk about that in part two.
I have sympathy up to a point. I'm not absolving them.
To a point.
Yeah.
In the next episode, I hope you enjoyed it. Hope to see you next week for part two of the 67 Exorcisms of Annalise Michelle.
Well, thanks for listening if you made it this far.
Wow.
See you next week.
See ya.